Well, good evening. When we met last together, which was 2 weeks back, Pastor Ben here introduced us to the ideas of God's infinitude. And really, we're going to add a little bit of specificity to that tonight. One curious point that he made, and one that I appreciated, was that God's infinitudes are not like mathematical infinitudes, in which a finite number expands to something uncountable. Instead, God's infinitude is such that he stands outside the traditional boundaries of space and time and length and width and height, even time. He's, in a word, supernatural. He stands outside the natural realm, and it's very difficult for us to wrap our minds about that because we are space-bound and time-bound creatures. For us, there is nothing other than space, and there is nothing other than time. And yet, for God, that's the case. God created time and space when, as yet, there was none of them. I think sometimes we tend to think that space and time have always been, and God came along one day to occupy them, but that's not the case. He created them. And this is, again, difficult for us to understand because we don't have categories in our minds to really grasp this for something that exists outside of space and time and can't even be observed within those categories. And I say all this not to wow you with ineffable thoughts here, but to, provide a sense of the difficulty of explaining the omnipresence and eternality of God, which very simply are the infinitude of God with respect to space and time, respectively. So we're going to start here tonight with the doctrine of God's omnipresence, which is defined here as God transcending spatial limitations so that he is present simultaneously and eternally in all places with the whole of his being. There are some who distinguish between the term omnipresence and the term immensity. Omnipresence meaning that God is everywhere in the presence with the whole of his being, and immensity meaning that he expands beyond it, that he transcends the spatial limitations of the universe. But most theologians tend to conflate those terms today and use them interchangeably. There's a great number of texts that we could appeal to establish the omnipresence of God here. 1 Kings 8:27 is perhaps one of the better ones. Does God really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain him. Of course, this is in the context of the building of the temple. And in the ancient world, the temples, among other things, the temples were designed there to house the gods and the sacrifices to feed the gods. And God wants to make sure that everyone understands that this temple doesn't serve that purpose. Because God can't be contained in a building. He can't be contained on the earth. In fact, he can't even be contained in the totality of space. Okay? And I think we also have a reference to that in Acts 17, 24 and 25. It speaks to the same idea that God does not dwell in houses made by human hands and does not need our sacrifices. He doesn't need anything. Okay? Jeremiah 23, 24. Am I simply a God nearby, declares the Lord, and not a God far away? We often tend to reverse those because we want a God who is near at hand, but he reminds us that he's not merely a God who is near at hand, nearby, but a God far away. Can anyone hide in secret places so I cannot see him, declares the Lord? Do not I fill heaven and earth? Psalm 139, verses 7 to 10. Again, a classic passage here on the omnipresence of God. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? Rhetorical questions. If I go to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, Sheol, the place of the dead, behold, you're there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn and I settle on the far side of the sea, this this great unknown, the sea. Even there, your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. So I think these are enough, but there's plenty of others that we could appeal to, but these are enough to establish here that God is everywhere present. But as with a lot of these definitions, we want to make some qualifications because there are some questions that might come up relative to this doctrine of omnipresence. Firstly, I want to make the point here that omnipresence doesn't mean that God is everything and that everything is God, which is what we sometimes call pantheism. Rather, God fills the universe in a metaphysical sense, not a physical sense. He's not physically present. He has no physical substance. But he is metaphysically present everywhere in his universe. No physical entity is God, although sometimes God chooses to make himself known through some sort of physical entity. Letter B here, number two here, my omnipresence means more than simply that God is a spirit being. There are other spirit beings out there, angels, for instance, demons, but these are not omnipresent, okay? In fact, I have some text there, Daniel 9, Daniel 10, where we have conversations with Gabriel. He was in one place, trying to get to another place, but is delayed for 3 weeks, okay? So, I'm not sure how angels get around, but they're not everywhere. They have to go from point A to point B. Not so with God. God is already intrinsically everywhere. Number three here, omnipresence doesn't mean that part of God is in one place and part of him is in another, or that he's thinly spread out. He's everywhere present with the whole of his being. It's not as though, and we're going to talk about this idea of drawing near to God and him drawing near to us. And the idea is not that he's absent or very nearly absent and has to sort of fill the place with his presence because he's not there. We'll talk about what that does mean in just a moment. Another qualification, omnipresence doesn't mean simply that the evidences of God's presence are everywhere. His being, not just his laws or his operations, are everywhere present. Okay, the deism is the idea, right? That God sort of wound up the universe and set it running, and that's how the world works, and he is absent. No, God is present with the whole of his being. It's he who is present, not simply what he started rolling. Letter number five here, omnipresence doesn't mean that God manifests himself uniformly throughout the universe. For instance, he doesn't dwell on earth in the same way that he dwells in heaven. You know, we sometimes pray, preached this morning in chapel on the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven." Well, why do we say that? I mean, if he's in this pew here, why don't we just say, "Our Father who's in the pew here"? Well, because, as we all know from various scriptures, Isaiah 6, Revelation, other places, he manifests himself most spectacularly in this place called heaven. Okay? So when we talk about him being in heaven, we're talking about a particular manifestation of God. Same thing is true of the fact that all persons in some sense are indwelt by God. Right, all person, God is everywhere. So he's as much inside your neighbor, who's a pagan, as he is inside of you. But he hopefully manifests himself more in your life than in your neighbor's life. So it's not a matter of his location per se, but rather the manifestation of his influence. Okay, so we have to recognize that God does not dwell on earth the same way he does in heaven. And he is not in the wicked in the same sense that he is in believers. And then the last point, furthering that, we note that God does not displace anything with any of his being. Just as the song we sang tonight, "Everywhere that man can be, thou God art present there." Or as Sam Storm puts it, God is where everything else is. The grandeur of God. Okay, so the omnipresence of God. Now, there's some objections here that are sometimes raised, and this is why I'll try and use this same pattern here for eternality as I do for omnipresence. Question is, how can God be in hell. I mentioned earlier in Psalm 139 that it says, if I make my bed in the depths, in Sheol, the place of the dead, sometimes it is translated hell, you're there. And so perhaps we might look at that and say, how is that possible? How could God be in hell? In fact, sometimes we're even told that hell is the absence of God, but that's not actually true. What makes hell so bad is the fact that he is there overseeing the judgments and not extending any form or any manifestation of grace. So he's there, but he's inaccessible. The blessings that ordinarily accrue to us in his common and special grace are just simply absent there in hell. So he's not suffering in hell. Don't imagine that. It's not as though he experiences hell like an unbeliever does. Yet he is there because he is everywhere in the, with the whole of his being. Then I mentioned earlier, what about this idea of God drawing near? We talked about God being near and far away. James 4:8 says we should draw near to God and he will draw near to us. So what does that mean? Well, that God is described in terms of being near or far away should not be taken as spatial, right, or locative, because he's everywhere. Nor should we think of these things in existential or mystical terms, as though his presence may somehow be felt more or less in one place or another by some sort of extrasensory perception. Instead, God's drawing near should be understood in the Hebrew sense of coming near as a manifestation of blessing or sometimes in judgment. So he draws near in the sense of extending his blessing to us. So drawing near is an expression of divine approval, or when he draws near in judgment, an expression of divine disapproval. So what are some of the practical values of the omnipresence of God? Well, negatively, no one can escape from God. I say in some sense that's negative, in some sense that is positive, because I think we all long for the day when the wrongs of this world are righted. And that's not vindictiveness, that's a yearning for divine justice, right? And no one will ever escape the hand of God. Jonah tried, right? He got into a ship, tried to go the opposite direction, didn't work, right? God found him. Amos 9 is an extended passage here detailing the fate of those who seek to avoid divine judgment. Let me just read here what it says. Not one will get away. None will escape. They may dig down to the depths of the grave, but from there my hand will take them. Though they climb to the heavens, from there I will bring them down. Though they hide themselves on the top of Mount Carmel, there I will hunt them down. I will seize them. Though they hide from me at the bottom of the sea, there I will command the serpent to bite them. Though they are driven into exile by their enemies, there I will command the sword to slay them. I will fix my eyes upon them for evil and not for good. So you can't escape God. But positively, right? Positively. The believer can never be abandoned. There's no way for us to ever be lost without God there. And we can even be, of all things, the dwelling place of God. That is, a place in which God is operating and causing us to advance in holiness and serve him as one of his people. Okay, so that's the omnipresence of God, the infinitude of God with respect to space. Now we turn the corner to the doctrine of the eternality of God. And if space is difficult, you know, being outside of space is difficult for us to wrap our minds around, it seems that the being outside of time is even harder. At least for me it is, right? I think if we think hard about space, even though it's mind-boggling, we can live with it. But time, it's mind-blowing. If God exists beyond time, then when is he? And this is what is meant by the eternity of God. Or perhaps to keep the omnis going, we could say that God is omnitemporal. Omnitemporal. Our definition here is that as the eternal God, he is the author of time, and his existence cannot be measured with time. The past, the present, and the future are all possessed by God in one indivisible present. Now for us, the time as we know it is marked by the succession of events, not so with God. He is not bound by that. He does not go through time like we do. God is above time. Now, there's a very limited sense in which we could say that we are above time. In a finite and analogous sense, we can aspire, we can remember, we can dream. But God is above them in an actual sense. He is outside of time. I sometimes use the illustration of, you know, John Madden with his telestrator, right? Okay, sort of above time, right? He can back it up even, you know, he can back up the videotape and move it forward and even do it slowly or back, you know, so if that picture helps you at all, we have a God who in an actual sense, not in terms of videotapes, actually can move within time, backwards, forwards, and everywhere, in fact. So how do we demonstrate this? Well, some key biblical texts here for that. Genesis 21:33, God is the God of the ages. If I can, the Lord of time. We sang that song too, right? God of the ages. He is the El Olam. And it speaks to His lordship over the concept of time. He stands over time and directs it. Exodus 3:14, remember when Moses was about to go and confront Pharaoh. He says, okay, who is this? Whose authority am I doing this in? And the answer is what? I am. Okay. And that probably gives us something of a sense of His existence. I'm the one who is, but probably more than that, it probably says something about His relationship to time. He exists in an eternal now. I am. In fact, that John 8:58, I think even presses that even further. Jesus says to His opponents, before Abraham was, I am. And that wasn't bad grammar, right? Okay. What He's saying here is, just to say before Abraham was, I was, would be an incredible statement, right? But He goes further. Before Abraham was, I am. In fact, that's really the only tense that God exists in. He is. Not that He was. I understand that we're going to actually look at a verse that says He is and was and will be. But the fact is, from His perspective, there is no succession of time. Psalm 90, verse 2. This is Psalm of Moses here. Before the mountains were born, or You brought forth the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, You are God. And 1 Corinthians 2:7, perhaps one of the more interesting paradoxes, right? God's decree extends before time began. If you think about that long enough, you say, okay, if it's before time, when is it? If it's not within time, when was it? Okay. And then Revelation 1, which we just referenced, I'm the Alpha and Omega, says the Lord who is and was and who is to come, the Almighty. Okay, so He is eternal. Again, we have some qualifications that we want to make here because there are some questions that emerge. One, I want again to make this point here that time is a system of measurement marked by the succession of events in a changing universe, but God is immutable. He exists outside of His transient universe, and so it's necessary to say that He exists not only outside of the space of His universe, but also outside the time. Time began when God created it. And while some of the passages above that we just looked at here convey something of a temporally linear sense, I think this is really just to accommodate the human writers. That's sometimes called an anthropomorphism, right? God is not merely everlasting, where He fills all of time, but also He is eternal. He transcends time. Another qualification I want to make here is the fact that God, even though He does not regard time as we do, right? A day for Him is as 1,000 years. 1,000 years is as a day. It doesn't mean that He can't interact with temporal beings or doesn't get the concept of time. Now, sometimes I've heard these verses appealed to say, okay, yeah, but the millennium is supposed to be 1,000 years, but remember, 1,000 years for God is like a day, and so it might only be a day long. Or it could multiply out the other direction. It could be incredibly long. Well, it's not as though God is unaware of what 1,000 years is or unaware of what a day is. It's not as though it's beyond his comprehension. But in terms of his intersection with the universe, he's not bound by time like we are. Okay? Some objections. First one here is a little bit of a technical one here. Sometimes it's argued that timelessness was invented by the Greeks, right? Pythagoras, Parmenides, Plato developed something of an advanced idea of the timelessness well before many of these passages that we read tonight were written. But, you know, even a stopped clock is right twice a day, right? So just because they got it right doesn't mean that it is for that reason wrong. And in fact, the scriptures are quite clear that this is the case. We mentioned here 1 Corinthians 2:7 doesn't make sense apart from the idea of timelessness, that he existed before time. Here's a line that Augustine makes about this. If God is before time, it is not in time that God precedes time. If this were so, he would not be before time. Okay, you know, it takes a while to process that one, right? But the fact is, if he's before time, that means he's outside of time. Not simply linearly before time. He's outside of time because time is a succession of events. I think also that the certain nature of God's decree suggests something about the eternality, the timelessness of God. I know we sometimes talk in the New Testament about a proleptic aorist where the past tense is used, even though it's actually a prophetic. No, God has seated us in the heavenlies. And we say, well, no, he hasn't. I'm right here in the auditorium. And yet we recognize, well, he hasn't actually seated us there. But the certainty of that is so great that he's able to put it in that past tense. But I wonder if it may be even more than that, that God already exists in that future time. And so he speaks not from a standpoint of, like we do, to look forward and say, this is the way it's going to be. He's actually there. He knows it. He can actually speak literally in the past tense there because he's already there. He's seen it. He knows the way it is. And I think all of God's attributes really reflect this quantitative and qualitative distinction between man and God. Okay, so I don't think there can be any temporal succession in God. Another objection here that's sometimes made, that God can't be timeless if he acts and reacts within time. So, for instance, God created and afterwards said it was good, or he prepared the prophets before they were born. And I think the answer to this one is fairly easy. God immutably and eternally decrees outside of time what is going to happen within time. And so he makes his manifestations within time. And so without any change or succession, he simply observes and is a part of what's going on. He's not bound by time, but it does not restrict himself from manifesting himself in time. Again, you know, the telestrator, right? Just because John Madden exists outside of it doesn't mean that you can't see the, you know, the little fingers go and the little circles and the X's and all that on the screen. Because he's able to interact here, God is, with the temporal realm. The last one's perhaps the hardest. What about Jesus? You know, Jesus is a localized expression here. He's a localized being. He is time-bound. He marches through time over the course of years. He continues to do so, right? Okay. And so we look at that and say, how do we explain this if, in fact, Jesus has some temporal restrictions? Well, again, this is, you know, Christology is a grand mystery to us. But the fact is that all the attributes work this way with Jesus, right? Jesus is localized, but God the second person isn't. You know, Jesus is mortal, But God, the second person, isn't mortal. He's immortal. And so we could walk through every single one of the attributes and say that just because Jesus expresses some limitations does not mean that the second person of the Trinity is entirely confined to that temporal expression of Jesus. And I recognize that this is, again, a complexity. It's difficult. It's part of the mystery. I think it's good for us to stretch ourselves and at the end of the day say, I'm still not sure I get it. Because the fact is, if we did, then God would cease to be God. The mystery would be gone. So I recognize this is a difficult topic, one that makes us scratch our heads, but I think it's a good thing that we do. One last thing here then is the practical value of the eternality of God. And I've got 3 points here. First, Deuteronomy 33, I think it's particularly helpful as we migrate towards our prayer time. There are everlasting arms in times of crisis. God is always there. There is never a time in which He is absent. Psalm 90, again, remember we mentioned this was a psalm of Moses. There's comfort in the midst of the brevity of life. Even, and he's apparently writing this as he's on Mount Pisgah's lofty height, right? When he knows his life is going to end before he achieves all that he wanted to do. And yet he is confident that there is confident that because of God's eternity, that he can be content. And then Psalm 102, though we die, God will not. Because He always is. I think all of these things can give us a confidence in our prayers, because we can come to Him with our prayers, because from His vantage, He knows all, He sees all, He is aware of all, He knows the end of all things, and He knows the best way to get us there. And in fact, when He answers differently than we expect, or other than what we are hoping, we have the confidence that, in fact, God is our Father who is in heaven, who is always there, and is, in His inscrutable wisdom, doing what is best for us. So as we go to prayer tonight, hopefully those things can govern the way we think about the request that we are praying about tonight. Ben?